Live Creative Now, episode 57.
Welcome to Live Creative Now with Melissa Dinwiddie, a weekly podcast to inspire you to create your art and share your work, because that's how you will change the world.
Hello, hello, hello. This is Melissa Dinwiddie, passion pluralite artist, happiness catalyst, and creativity instigator, here to address all your questions about living a full-color creative life. Whether you think of yourself as not artistic, not creative, which is how I thought of myself for years, or you think of yourself as an artist of any kind, or anything in between, no matter how you define yourself, feeding your creative hungers makes you feel more alive. And I always say at the end of this, it's how you change the world. But maybe you don't care about changing the world. It's how you make life better for not just you, but everyone around you. So whether you want to change the world or just make your life and the people around you make their lives better, feeding your creative hungers will do that. Anyway, in my last episode, episode 56, I answered the question that was posed to me, what does being an artist mean to you? This was asked by Ellie Trier, who is a fellow creator and teacher, and she's running this really cool month-long event called Demystifying the Artist. And if you get on her mailing list, and I've included a link in the show notes at livecreativenow.com/056 for episode 56, if you get on her mailing list, then every day in May, the remaining days in May, she will send you a new essay from a different artist. And sometimes they include audio or video, sometimes they're just written, but they're all responses to that question, what being an artist means to each person. So go check out episode 56 for more on that. The timing was very appropriate for that episode, number 56, because this weekend I'm holding an open studio in my home, in my backyard, and in my dining room, living room area. All of the paintings that I've made in the past few years are going to be on display and on sale. We're talking a lot of paintings. I have not counted them all up, but I know there are well over 100. So there's going to be a lot of artwork here. So if you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, drop on by this weekend. I will include a link in the show notes to all of the relevant details on how to get here and what you need to know. So it's so interesting to me because, you know, there were many, many years in my life where I not only didn't consider myself an artist, I truly believed that I was not creative. And it took me a long time, even after I dove into art with very serious intentions back in my late 20s, took me a really long time to call myself an artist. And for a while, that was how I made my entire living, was from my art. And now that part of my income is just become a fraction of where I get my revenue. And yet I am in some ways more confident about calling myself an artist now than I was back then, because I'm owning it for me. Because it's not about, I mean, I'd love to sell all of the paintings at my open studio. That'd be phenomenal. But it's not about whether they sell or not, whether anybody else likes what I make or not. It's just about doing the thing that feeds me, that feeds my soul. And I know you know what I'm talking about, because there's something for you that's like that as well. But you may not know what that thing is yet, or what those things, plural, are yet. And that is what this episode is about. I am talking today about finding your passion. In fact, I'm talking about four lies about finding your passion, plus the truth about finding your passion, which might be really different from what you would expect. And this episode is inspired by an article that I wrote on the blog back in 2012. So, gosh, 4 years ago now. And I'll include a link in the show notes to that original post. If you already have a passion, or if you have several passions, as I do, if you're a passion pluralite, or if you have one passion, either way, you might find this episode really illuminating. But if you don't have a passion yet, but you would like one, this episode is for you. So let's get on with it. So the original article that this is inspired by was called Four Lies and a Truth About Finding Your Passion. Like Four Weddings and a Funeral, if you ever saw that movie. Anyway, a number of years ago, I was chatting with some friends over a potluck dinner at our synagogue, and I had started my blog, and I was up on my soapbox about empowering people to follow their passion, because that's what I felt like I really wanted to do. And one woman said, "What if you don't have a passion? How do I even find one in order to follow it? How do I follow my bliss if I don't even know what it is?" Because I had all this language about following your bliss, and your bliss evolves, so you got to keep following it as it bounds off in a different direction from what you expected. And her question just sort of brought me to a screeching halt. I didn't know how to respond. I had spent a number of years of my own life devoid of passion. I didn't feel like I had passion for many years. And then I found my bliss when I was a teenager and had that for a few years, was super serious about it, lost that to injury. And it took almost a decade before I found something else that really felt like a passion to me. And for a long time, it felt like I would never find another passion, that I just, you know, had my one shot when I was young, and I could feel grateful for that, because how many people go through their lives and they never find a passion? And, you know, okay, I had some moments of color in my life, and I would live out the rest of my life in shades of gray, because that's really how it felt. I had no answer for this woman while I was sitting at this potluck table, and here I was. I had all these new passions in my life. I was an artist, and I had discovered music, and I was writing, and I had no idea what to say to her. And so I thought about it. How did I discover my various passions? And I realized that part of the reason that I didn't have an answer for that woman is that the words we use, the rhetoric that we typically use when we talk about life passions, that rhetoric is all wrong. We talk about finding your passion, discovering your passion, as if it's, you know, like behind some closed door, and all you have to do is open the handle and boom, passion, eureka. And when I looked back at my own life, I realized that although I often told my story of finding my, you know, my stories, plural, about finding my various passions as if they happened that way, that actually wasn't the truth. That was a lie. So let's take a look at those lies. So lie number one is about my relationship with dance. I have said so many times that I couldn't even possibly count that I discovered dance at age 16, and I fell instantly madly in love with it. And that makes a really great story, but it's a lie. That is not the truth. In fact, what happened was I took some music, creative movement classes when I was like 4 years old. And then I didn't take any dance classes through elementary school junior high. I think because I was intimidated, the idea of, I don't know, the scary ballet teacher with the big stick or something. And then finally in ninth grade, my first year in high school, a few friends of mine, we all wanted to, MTV was this new thing, and we all wanted to play around with dancing, right? So we signed up together for a modern dance class. Well, that class turned out to be classical modern dance. And we had no idea what that meant. But, you know, we were expecting, I guess, sort of pop culture dance that you know, now would be often referred to as jazz dance, which is a big misnomer because it has nothing to do with jazz and nothing to do with improvisation, which jazz music is all about improvisation. But in any case, that's what it was called. And I think that's what we were expecting. And I remember, like, rolling my eyes a lot in this class. It was not what we were looking for. We wanted to be, like, hip and cool. And we were doing these sort of weird movements. And it didn't excite me. And we took that one class. It was 6 or 8 weeks long or whatever, and then never went back. And then in high school, I did take 2 years of dance classes through the PE department, physical education department. But calling them dance classes feels a little bit, I don't know, a little bit not entirely just fully descriptive. I don't know. The teacher was pretty heavy set, and she didn't really teach us any technique to speak of. We learned some moves. We did learn a little bit of tap. We learned how to do a kickball change and a few different things, and we got to move to music. And it was a huge godsend that it existed, so I didn't have to do the football, basketball, volleyball. Oh my God, all that was so torturous to me, all those various different ball sports that I was really sucky at. So I didn't have to suffer through those. But it wasn't until the summer before my senior year in high school, when I was 16, after those 2 years of PE dance, that I finally took what I consider what I considered at the time a real dance class at a local private dance school. And that was the moment that, to me, felt like the discovery moment. That was the moment when my passion started to just blossom, and this, like, wham, eureka moment. But here's the thing. If I hadn't had the exposure to dance that I did have in the few years before that, there wouldn't have even been a eureka moment then. I think my previous experiences with dance were what planted the seed. And it was repeated exposure over time, with practice, with ongoing engagement, that was what fertilized the growth of that particular passion. So it wasn't a matter of opening a door and wham, here's my passion. It felt that way when I started that, when I took that first class at the local dance school, the jazz dance class. I had that feeling of, oh my God, I want to do this all the time. But I'd actually been dancing. I'd taken other dance classes for a few years before that. So that's lie number one. Lie number two is all around my next passion in my life, calligraphy. And I have been known to tell the story many, many times that I picked up a calligraphy pen at age 28 and I fell in love. Actually, it might have been 27. No, it was 28, whatever. Anyway, it makes a great story to say that, but it's a lie. The truth is that my brother gave me a set of Schaefer calligraphy fountain pens many years before that. I'm not sure if it was high school or college, but he gave me a set of these pens, and I had pulled them out once or twice, played with them once or twice, and then put the box on a shelf and forgot about it. And then years later, after I graduated from college, I was trying to figure out what I was going to do with my life, because dance hadn't worked out because I'd gotten injured. And I just graduated from college, so like, now what do I do? And I remember I pulled that box of pens off the shelf and I had this thought, like, oh, maybe I'll be a calligrapher. I'm not exactly sure where that thought even came from. But over the course of about a week, I practiced some letters at the kitchen table every day. And I went down to the College Career Center to see what they had to say about professional calligrapher as a job, as a profession, as a career. And there was, in fact, a file for calligrapher, but it only had a handful of articles in it. And from what I could tell from those articles, it seemed that the only thing calligraphers ever did was address envelopes and fill in certificates with people's names and dates and stuff like that. And oh my God, that just seemed so boring, not nearly interesting enough to keep me practicing at the kitchen table. So literally after about a week, the pens got stuck back in their box and put on the shelf again for 5 years. It wasn't until I was 28 that I pulled out my calligraphy pens again after I'd started making art. I was actually doing paper cutting, and suddenly it seemed like calligraphy would be this really useful skill for somebody who was interested in the idea of somehow turning my art into a business. Now, there's no internet back then, so there were not a whole lot of role models for how to turn, you know, my creative thing into a business. So it seemed to me that the only way to do that would be to have a skill that people would pay me, you know, to do, commission me to do things with this skill. And so all of a sudden, this seemed really exciting to me. And what had previously seemed really boring, practicing letters, now had this really intriguing glow. And I just immersed myself in letter forms and pens and ink and books and classes and workshops. And within a matter of months, this interest in lettering and calligraphy had turned into a full-fledged passion. And again, though I often think about it and certainly have told stories about it as a eureka moment, in fact, my passion for calligraphy grew really gradually over a period of years. So that is lie number two. Lie number three has to do with my relationship to music. So I kind of have a couple, well, at least two big musical passions. Singing is definitely a passion of mine. And, you know, the story that I've told over and over again is that I discovered jazz at age 38, 10 years after I discovered calligraphy, right? And I discovered it when a friend gave me a home-burned CD, a compilation CD with classic tracks from about, I don't know, 20 different jazz vocalists. And I signed up for a jazz singing class because I wanted to learn how to sing like that. And I was instantly hooked. And then another of my big musical passions is ukulele. And back in 2010, after my whole life never having the slightest interest in the ukulele, except when I was a really little kid and my parents had a couple of ukuleles that they'd bought in Hawaii or something, and my brother and I used to bang away on them pretending they were guitars. That was my only exposure to playing the ukulele. The story is that I took a ukulele class at music camp in 2010, and I fell madly in love with the ukulele. Both of those stories about singing and about the ukulele are lies. Well, not entirely lies. They did happen. But my passion for making music did not spring fully formed like Athena from the head of Zeus from either one of those incidents. Jazz was not this brand new thing. I'd heard it throughout my life. Now, my parents were not jazz people, so we didn't have jazz records around. I didn't even realize that these great songs that, you know, I knew from hearing them around in films and on television and stuff, I didn't even know they were jazz. And it certainly never occurred to me that I might sing them and perform them in front of people, you know, like with bands and stuff. I also had 7 years of piano lessons as a kid. 7 years. And then another 7 years, let's see, it was first grade through seventh grade playing piano, and then fourth grade through 10th grade, fourth, fifth, sixth, seventh, eighth, and ninth, yeah, 7 years playing violin and viola. In fifth and sixth grades, I sang in a choir. And in college, I did a couple of musicals where I sang. One of those, I actually had a solo. So did not think of myself as a singer, but I had a solo in this musical. And oh yeah, in first grade, I took a summer school class playing the guitar. So, you know, it would be a total lie to say that making music was not part of my life. It was a really big part of my life. I still walk around the house singing just for the fun of making sounds with my voice. But it wasn't a passion. I was one of those kids that had to be like coaxed to practice. I just remember my mother, oh my God, just nagging me to practice. It was not something I was thrilled about. And it wasn't until, gosh, well into adulthood that the music bug really bit me. Before I played the ukulele, I played the guitar, and I picked it up around 32 years old. And I hadn't played it since first grade. And at 32, it was so much more interesting to me than it had been in first grade. I had this desire to be able to play a song and sing it at the same time, even if it was just me alone in my living room with my guitar. I really liked that idea. That wasn't an issue for me when I was in first grade. And then before I picked up the guitar in my 20s and 30s, I belonged to this little tiny synagogue that was led by members of the congregation. And because I could carry a tune, I got tapped pretty early on to help lead the services and lead the singing. There's lots of singing and rounds and things at some of the services. So I was doing a lot of singing, and I actually started taking voice lessons because I kept going hoarse. I have this tendency to get hoarse really easily, and I wanted to learn how not to do that. And that eventually led to the jazz singing class at 38, which is when I got really, really passionate about it. So in other words, little by little, I kind of gradually wandered into love with music, which is how I refer to falling in love with my sweetheart, my husband. It wasn't a eureka, you know, love at first sight thing for us. Maybe for him, but not for me. It took me 2.5 years to even see him as a contender. So I refer to that as gradually wandering into love as opposed to falling into love or falling in love. And that's what happened with music, with my, you know, having music becoming a passion for me. It eventually evolved into a passion, but it was a long time in coming. So that's line number three. So we've got dance, calligraphy, and music. And then line number four is writing. Now, this doesn't really fit with the same structure of the other ones, but I wanted to include it because it's so ironic, because the truth is that probably most of what I do professionally nowadays as a creativity instigator is write. And even when I'm doing a podcast or a speech or teaching a class, so much of what I'm doing is writing to create the content. And expressing myself in words, that is one of my core creative pursuits. So writing definitely qualifies as one of my life passions. But although I've been writing my entire life, it was never something I felt passionate about until I started my blog in 2010. In fact, way back in 1995, the reason that I started making art, which is what got me into calligraphy, is because I was procrastinating from writing. I decided for a brief period in 1995 that I wanted to be a writer, but I kind of hated actually writing. Now, that's a little more complicated because the reason I hated writing is because I thought that I sucked at it and I was so stuck in perfectionist paralysis and the comparison trap. But the fact remains that writing was not a passion for me at that point. And in fact, it really dropped off my radar as I became more passionate about making art. And for 15 years, the only writing I really did was in my journal. You know, I would take notes and jot down my thoughts and do brain dumps and stuff like that. It was a very pragmatic endeavor, not a passionate one. And it was only when I discovered a larger purpose for my writing. It was only when I discovered a larger purpose to make a difference, to figure out my thinking on a given subject, to spread my ideas. That is when writing started to take on the glow of passion. So those are my lies about finding your passion. Now let's talk about the truth about finding your passion. I actually have a lot more stories than that. For a number of years, I was super passionate about yoga. I still love yoga, although I haven't been doing it a whole lot lately. But I went through teacher training and I taught for a little bit. But when I first started yoga, my very first yoga class, which was probably 26 years ago, I did not like it. I was a dancer at that point in my life, or identified as a dancer, and I did not like this weird, the body postures didn't make sense to me. But something about it appealed to me. I don't even remember what, because I kept at it in, you know, bits and snatches. I kept at it until eventually it grew into a passion. For a number of years, I was passionate about Judaism. I was born Jewish, but never had any Jewish education, and got really interested as an adult in my 20s, and I had an adult bat mitzvah at age 31. I was on the board of my synagogue. I edited the synagogue newsletter and produced it. I chaired the Shalom committee, the welcoming committee, and I taught myself to read Hebrew, not for comprehension, but just to pronounce it. And I still help lead the High Holiday services for my synagogue every year. But as a kid, I was completely disdainful of organized religion, partly because I saw Judaism as, you know, just another patriarchal religion, which had nothing to say to me as a female. In fact, it was actually the first patriarchal religion. And I had less than zero interest. I wanted nothing to do with it. And it wasn't until my late 20s when I discovered that Judaism and feminism were not necessarily mutually exclusive that I got interested in learning more. So it was another case of sort of wandering into love. I have more stories too, but what all of these stories have in common is that each life passion wasn't inborn. I wasn't born with it, and nor was it a eureka moment. It developed gradually over time. Because here's the thing, passion, when we think about passion, it seems like it's so intense, right? And it burns so fiercely that it's easy to forget that it started off as an ember, as a little, maybe a little spark, maybe a little glow, very low glow, not this spontaneous combustion thing. That's not really how it happens. Now, right as I was trying to put all of my thoughts around finding a passion into words in the blog post that inspired this podcast episode, serendipitously, there was an article on Jonathan Field's website by somebody named Barry Davenport, who's a certified life passion coach. Who knew there was such a thing, but apparently there is. And she, reading that article was so just serendipitous, because she's broken life passion down into an equation. And that equation really resonates with me. her equation is strong interest plus practice plus engagement plus purpose equals life passion. So here's how that works. You have a strong interest in something, so you begin to practice it to gain proficiency, and either you do or do not become increasingly engaged in it. And if you do become engaged, then you continue to practice and you pursue it more fervently. And as a result, it takes on a meaning in your life and it fulfills you in ways that support your values. And then that's when it has a larger purpose. And as she writes, one day you wake up and realize you are passionate about this something. You love it. It's part of you, and you'll find a way to make it happen come hell or high water. And she continues, more often than not, the above described scenario takes a long time, maybe years. And dang it, you know, that was like this bell rang over my head, because that is exactly what happened for me with each one of the passions that I described before. And now, of course, I wish I could go back to that potluck dinner at my synagogue, because now I know what I would say to that woman who wanted to know, what do you do when you don't even have a passion? How do you find it? I would tell her to go try things. I would tell her, follow the tiniest little interests that appear on your radio. Do stuff. Work at it for a bit. If it doesn't engage you, then fine. Follow your nose. Allow yourself to follow your nose to something else. And then wash, rinse, and repeat until something tugs at you more, a little more powerfully. And know that that might take a while. Barry Davenport has a wonderful quote that I really like about life passion. She writes, the process of transformation from investigating a strong interest to waking up and recognizing it as your passion is a passionate experience itself. This is really important. And what this means for you, if you don't feel like you have a passion and you would like to find one, this is really great, because it's your first opportunity to start to bring passion into your life, because your quest for a passion, that can become a passionate experience. You get to take pleasure in that journey. You never know, that thing you tried and dropped many years ago because it was boring, or maybe it was too hard, or who knows what, maybe that will reemerge later as a real, honest-to-goodness life passion, if you give it a chance. That's the key. You have to give it a chance. The prescription to follow your bliss, oh my gosh, when somebody says that and you don't feel like you have a bliss, it just feels ridiculous, right? I have so been there, so I get it. But even if you don't have a bliss, you can follow something. And if you do that enough, you might find yourself gradually wandering into love with one of those somethings that you follow. And then eventually you might wake up and wham, passion. But watch out. You may also find yourself forgetting that your relationship with your passion was ever less than passionate. And then you will be telling the same kinds of lies, the Eureka stories, that I have been telling. So, those are my four lies and a truth about finding your passion. And I'm really curious. I want to know if you feel like you already have a passion, or maybe more than one. I'm really curious, was your experience a Eureka moment, or was it more of gradually wandering into love? Leave a comment over on the podcast episode, the show notes page, livecreativenow.com/057, or shoot me an email. I'm really, really curious what your experience was like. So that's it. That's a wrap. Thank you so much for joining me today. I hope that was useful. I would love to hear from you if it was. If you could use some time to investigate maybe one of the things you're interested in, or maybe to dive in to a passion if you already have one, come join me in August. I'm holding my fourth annual Create and Incubate Retreat, 5 days, 4 nights in the beautiful hills above Silicon Valley in Los Gatos, California, from August 17th through 21st. I would love to have you join me. You know, it is so hard to stay focused on your creative thing, your passions, when you also have to deal with laundry and cooking and getting the kids to soccer and emails and phone calls and errands and on and on and on and on. And that is why it is so valuable to go on a creative retreat. And at Create and Incubate Retreat, you will have 5 days of uninterrupted create time in a room we call the Creative Incubator for the duration of the retreat, where everybody else is also working on their creative projects, all in companionable silence. You don't have to worry about somebody coming up and trying to start a conversation with you in the incubator, because the incubator is the space where we create. You might want to work on your novel or paint or scrapbook or write out that ebook or design the course that you've been wanting to teach or even work on your business strategy for next quarter. Whatever you want to work on is all good. You don't have to answer phones. There's no laundry, no cooking. The meals are all prepared for you 3 times a day. And it is just so magical when you get together in a room with a group of other creators and everyone's immersed in their own creativity. It's this special buzz of energy, and it ramps everyone's creative power up to turbo. It's just so energizing. And these retreats, these deep dives, really fuel my well for months, which is why I have made going to retreats like this a priority in my life and why I host them now, because I want to help other people experience that energizing, deep creative dive. So I hope you'll join me. You can find out more about my Create and Incubate Retreat at createandincubateretreat.com. So that's it for today's episode. I'd love to see you at the retreat. If you're in the San Francisco Bay Area, come visit me at my open studio this weekend, May 21st and 22nd from 11 a.m. to 5 p.m. All the info you need is in the show notes. Go get creating. See you next week. Live creative now. Live creative now. Subscribe at livecreativenow.com.